broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain, British Columbia. This is CJSF 90.1 FM.
Listen, unlike pretty much every other podcast, we do not take summers off. We publish throughout the year. But like other podcasts, we do take some time off during the summer, and we air some reruns, and this is the last one before we get back into the swing of things with our fall season. It's a good one. This is an interview from our archives that a lot of people have not heard. You probably have not heard it, but it is an interview with the fantastic Chantal Hibert. Chantal Hibert, of course, is a panelist for the CBC's At Issue panel. She is a longtime political correspondent. Until very recently, she was the Toronto Star's, I would say, best political columnist. She just gave that up. And there was a point in time, the 1995 referendum, when you could credibly argue that her journalism held this country together. You will hear exactly how that played out in this interview. Here is my 2015 interview with Chantal Hibert. Wait for it.
So what is it exactly you want to talk about?
I don't know. This may be a terrible test of your patience.
No, you can't test my patience. I have time to kill. You may think I'm a busy person, but I am not.
You may be just too annoyed after this. I don't know.
Really get annoyed.
I'm a very ignorant person when it comes to Canadian politics.
I'm a very ignorant person in general, so we should get along just fine.
I'm ignorant for somebody who covers the Canadian media, but I may even be ignorant of Canadian politics as a Canadian citizen.
You probably know more than you think, voters.
I take no responsibility for my ignorance. I blame Canada's political press.
Okay. I blame, in part, voters.
Yeah.
And I say that as someone who spent 3 long years writing at the end of every story on the Meech-Lake Accord. The Meech-Lake Accord recognizes Quebec as a distinct society, gives it a veto over Senate reform, says that provinces have to submit names for the Supreme Court for 3 years. The lament, we don't know what's in the Meech-Lake Accord. Right.
It's the Meech Lake Accord. You've already lost a lot of people right there.
Well, when they came out and said, we have found a way to fix the Constitution and have national reconciliation, a hell of a lot of people paid attention, right?
That's more interesting.
I remember Le Devoir's headline that said, the headline the next day was, Canada says yes to Quebec.
Yeah.
In my lifetime, I saw those headlines. Maybe if not as many people had ended up caring about the Meech Lake Accord, it would have passed. But it became a perception issue.
Yes.
And you're right on one point. And we're not talking about the Meech Lake Accord here. We're talking about ignorance. The people who made that accord, who were premiers and prime minister and leader of the opposition in the case of the federal ones, decided that because they had a deal, they didn't need to explain it.
Right.
And they left this vacant field to people who didn't like the deal and who could speak the language. By the time they woke up and discovered that since they decided they shouldn't make their case to people, others had made the case for them, and it was now a lost cause. It was too late.
If only there was some institution in society whose job it was to engage people and inform them about what's going on.
You want to see the pile of stuff that people who cover politics wrote, talk to normal people, covered Pierre Trudeau, wrote lengthy explanation about every single section of that accord, tried in other ways to show that for Quebecers, yeah, Quebecers are different. Distinct does not mean superior, but you can't deny that they're different. It's very hard for Quebecers to understand why other Canadians would not know that they're distinct and different. There are only so many ways you can say something until you come to the conclusion that in the end, the Canadian elite said yes to Quebec, but the Canadian people in the end said no. The Meech Lake Accord wasn't a constitutional story. It was a story about how we talk past each other.
Yes.
And yes, the media has a responsibility for those failures, because for a long time, the story that's more exciting takes over from the story that's more constructive.
But are they not the same story? Like, if not for the journalism you did during the referendum, it sounds to me like there's a good chance, the margin was so small, you tell Quebecers that they are actually lobsters about to be boiled, and you could turn a bunch of people off of that referendum. You may have actually played a crucial role in keeping this country together. That's interesting.
Others would argue that I probably played a crucial role in shoring up sovereignty numbers with my coverage of the constitutional debate. At the end of the day, I don't think it works really well for journalists to feel so invested with social responsibility that they self-censor themselves in case they may have contributed to one outcome versus another. Because at that point, you're no longer doing whatever it is you do. That lobster story was the only real brown envelope. They don't exist anymore, I know, but I managed to get one real brown envelope in all of my life.
Yeah.
It landed in the mailbox of La Presse in July when I was alone. I opened it. It was a memo from one civil servant to another at Foreign Affairs, and it said Jacques Parizeau had told the EU ambassadors when he was asked, what if Quebecers vote yes in 3 months? And then they changed their minds. They decided they don't like it. And he went, ho, 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 it's going to be too late. They're going to be like lobsters in a lobster pot. One of these ambassadors wants a favor from Canada to get a seat on some council somewhere. I'm offering you this tidbit in exchange for you liking me, the civil servant types it. And I kind of looked at it and thought, do I really have to go through this? Like, I could see what was going to happen if I didn't take that envelope and put it in the trash can.
I've had that feeling where you just feel like, no one knows that I saw this.
Do I really want...
Yeah.
What's going to be happening for the next... And in the end, I mean, in hindsight, it's always more fun than when you're in it and you're the person who wakes up with the paper on the doorstep. You see your byline and this, les Québécois vont être comme des homards, and you think, this is going to be fun to cover. I mean, in the end, we got the story. The good thing about the story is instead of going with the story, just, you know, we have a memo from Foreign Affairs. I asked around. I had good connections in those days to the U.S. Embassy. They weren't there, but they had the best connections to anything. And they immediately confirmed that it had happened. But that wasn't a source. It wasn't on the record. What was great about the story is that in the end, we did have an ambassador on the record. And the only reason we got that is that Mr. Parizeau's office sent us that ambassador thinking he was going to deny the story.
Really? He had denied it. He sent you the diplomat.
Well, Parizeau's office eventually got wind of what was happening.
Uh-huh.
Jean-François Lisée, who was working then for Jacques Parizeau as a senior advisor, called me up. It was Friday afternoon and explained to me how I would not have a job as of Sunday if I went with the story. We went through the usual, I'm going to have your job while I'm sorry. And then he says, if I gave you people who were there, ambassadors, on the record, denying that Mr. Parizeau said this, what would you do? Well, I said, well, I'd certainly, you know, quote them.
Mm-hmm.
And then he said, it's Friday afternoon. Would you give us till Monday? So I called my bosses and I made the case to them that this is the Premier of Quebec. We should probably give him the benefit of the doubt in the 3 days and do the story Tuesday. On Monday, nothing happens for hours. And finally, someone from the Belgium embassy calls. He's the Belgian ambassador. And he starts telling me, he said, Jean-François Lisée called, and he asked me to call you. And I have to say that I'm very sorry that Mr. Parizeau's confidence has been betrayed. And I go, excuse me, but you do realize you've just confirmed that Mr. Parizeau did say that. Oh, yes, he did say that, but he said it in confidence. I never figured out what game Belgium was playing. And so I assumed afterwards when I thought about the story that the Belgium ambassador probably liked the no side better than the yes side, and so decided to confirm it all this time, protesting that it was so sad that Mr. Parizeau was betrayed. But the thing is, what I discovered months later, when all this was done, says there were ambassadors who said, I didn't hear him say that.
Yeah.
It's because he said that to three of them as they were having cocktails before his speech.
I mean, this is just an incredible story.
You know, it's one of those, I don't do this kind of journalism anymore.
Yeah.
But I did enjoy the chase.
Yeah.
And what you do once you're done. I did have a lot of fun doing that. That's that is a part of it that I do miss. And you can't be a columnist and do that, because the kind of columns you write, in the end, the temptation to shore up your own scoops would be too great.
I mean, yeah. You got to report a column as well sometimes, but...
Yes, but it's not the same.
No.
In French, we call it confusion des genres. You can't be party and analyst at the same time. And if you're breaking news, you are party to a dynamics that is different.
You are in this world of punditry now and yes. Analysis. And so you just made the face.
I dislike the word pundit intensely.
So that's the face you just made. I'm going to show you, because this is actually an image that illustrates how I feel when I am watching a lot of punditry. And
yes, I never see that. I'm not even looking. I've never seen myself on TV.
This is an animated GIF of you on the At Issue panel.
Yeah.
Responding to one of your fellow pundits.
The love thing. I've heard about it.
This is an epic eye roll. This is just such an expression of exasperation.
I know.
Only because I have you as my proxy can I watch this, because that's how I feel.
Yeah, well, don't show me, because I try to work on the face thing. Sometimes I can't help it.
Oh, it's wonderful.
And in that instance, the thing with the At Issue panel that's good, but that also makes these faces happen, is you don't know what the others are going to say.
Yeah.
Since you don't know, sometimes you're not totally
sometimes
prepared.
Sometimes you make the accident of being very honest.
I'm not very good at the poker face thing, which is why I don't watch myself on TV, because I'd probably not go on TV.
I feel like there's an assumption being made that I am going to be very interested in politics as sport, and that I'm very interested. And like any sport, it gets to statistics and dramatics and interpersonal relationships. And it's not necessarily, I find that it's rare to encounter a discussion about politics as something that actually matters to people, that is consequential.
I think a lot of people actually find politics more interesting when you explain to them what is behind the scenes. It's maybe the opposite of watching a movie, where you're not terribly interesting in being in the editing room, mm-hmm. because it's going to go on forever. The reactions we get from the panel, of course, people in the chattering class like the panel. I mean, they're mostly political junkies. But I don't think that because everyone is interested in the power and politics kind of stuff means that the people who are interested shouldn't have that show.
Sure. Let there be many flowers bloom. If you're a wonk, there should be wonk shows. But I guess, can we not agree that there is a problem in a country with voter turnout as it is in Canada? Can we not agree that there's a problem along generational lines? We do not have the most enfranchised and engaged and active population.
I think part of the reason for that is that we are fortunate enough not to have huge problems. It's easier to be engaged when the government is thinking of joining a war in Iraq that George W. Bush is leading, or when you are having a huge national debate over the death penalty or the right to abortion, or even free trade with the United States, than when your biggest issue is whether it's okay to allow people to put 10,000 rather than 5,000 a year in the TSFA. The issues that consume national governments and public opinion were issues that national governments could actually advance, solve, or make worse.
Mm-hmm.
But today, the issues that people care about a lot, climate change, the trade-offs between privacy, security, international terrorism, even the global economy and what happens to your job when it gets taken away, they are all issues that don't get resolved on the national stage anymore. We will still be having the same debate, which will not be completely resolved by a national government. These days, the Prime Minister spends more time meeting the President of France than he does meeting the Premier of Ontario. That wouldn't have happened 20 years ago. Why does that happen? Because the Prime Minister actually needs to discuss stuff with the President of France that is more relevant to the issues than he would if he sat with the Premier of Ontario.
But it's resolution may be a tall order. When we talk about the difference between having a bill like C-51, having a slightly different version of it that the Liberals might present, or not having it at all, that's a big difference that gets settled on the federal level. Whether or not you have a government that is completely in partnership with the oil patch or not is something that gets settled at the federal level.
Yes, and the majority of Canadians vote the way they vote, which is against current government, but then they split their votes between two parties.
And then many of them don't vote at all.
Well, it's a right to not vote if you don't feel engaged. When Quebec had a referendum, 94% showed up to vote.
Yes, but
when we discussed free trade, more than 80% turned out. So when you give people a choice, they do show up. But if they don't show up, it's because they don't think that there's enough of a choice to make it all worth their while to go vote.
Well, it has to do with what people think, and the magic word again is engagement, and then I say, whose job is that?
It's certainly not the job of the media to create engagement where issues and politicians don't.
Really?
I don't think so. I know. I don't buy the social mission. It's my job to report and give as much information as I can in context so that people can make reasoned decisions. But I cannot make the politicians more engaging. I cannot force them to actually talk to people.
You can make the issues more engaging.
No, I can't. No, I can't. I am not a priest. I don't go on in church on a Sunday to preach, this is what should be important to you and this is not. Even if I tried, I would get it wrong.
I think I'm kind of discussing a shift, a possible shift in the climate of the conversation. You know, some time ago I had Susan Delacourt here, and she you know, argued quite passionately that she's never experienced, I hope I'm paraphrasing her correctly, such a docile time in the Ottawa press, that in every sense, from the level of access that the press has denied and has accepted.
I've always found the Ottawa press to be docile.
Always.
I find press galleries in general, not just in Ottawa. It's not a criticism of my colleagues as much as a finding about press galleries in general tend to see the government in power as the government in power forever. And if we're going to describe docility in the press gallery, can we just wind back the clock to Jean Chrétien and Paul Martin's era when no one had a single conservative Canadian Alliance name in his or her Rolodex because the Liberals were going to be there forever, were they not?
Right.
And the day that the Conservatives come, with Stephen Harper as Prime Minister, lo and behold, what has happened to all those great Liberal contacts? Usually your colleagues 6 months before who then switched over to the dark side, and we're going to feed you stories forever because the Liberals, were they not going to be there forever? So if we're going to talk about a docile press gallery, can we somehow remember that it wasn't very assertive when the Liberals were in power? I don't remember those great challenging stories of, you know, how the Liberals are keeping from us when Jean Chrétien visits his riding. We're because they were nicer in my young age. I got to watch some of those Friday news conferences that Pierre Trudeau used to give.
Yeah.
Sometimes I walk in a park on the way to buy a baguette in the morning just to make a caricature of my life, and there is a man that feeds pigeons.
Yeah.
And it reminds me of those news conferences. I mean, I have not seen any prime minister give regular news conferences that were not to his advantage.
Mm-hmm.
Where I would agree with Susan somewhere is that in the face of a government that really will do nothing for you, it would be nice if the press gallery became more aggressive in looking for stories rather than in against that government, because it's more interesting to dig out stories. And if the press gallery dug out more disturbing stories, I'm not meaning scandals here, but more stories that don't make the government happy about having stories, the government would start keeping the press gallery busier.
Yeah.
And that is the dynamics. When I was a really young Parliament Hill person, I was invited, because I was the bureau chief of one, to one of those kind of mediated meetings between the civil service, the top civil service, and the parliamentary press gallery. And I sat there mute because here I'm sitting there, I could be in diapers, and they're all very senior people.
Okay.
And one of the more senior journalists at the table was the bureau chief of a major bureau, told this deputy minister across the table, he says, you know, the way to control a journalist who is good at getting scoops out, the best way to control that journalist is to give him or her 3 scoops a month. And I listened to that, and I was a bit shocked to hear it. And then I thought about it, and it stayed with me. But that is quite true. If you make the government worried about what you may be up to, it's going to go out of its way to keep you busy.
Sure, but then they have enemies who are going to go out of their way to make you busy in a different direction, and then maybe you've got some autonomy where you're looking for your own stuff, but that's how it should be.
Yes.
Right.
But the press gallery has less resources, and newspapers seem to be happy with boring political stories rather than
that's an issue
more
right
edgy
there.
Ones.
Is it an issue as well, as Susan suggested, that we become too cozy and there's too many journalists who want to be senators or who are writing speeches?
No evidence that we are cozier than we were. I'm just saying I haven't noticed that, and I'm not a big Ottawa person. I work out of Montreal. I visit my office not often, so I don't have a social life in Ottawa. It's not because I'm pure.
Yeah.
It's because that's not the life I have. I have kids and stuff and a real life.
You've been described as the consummate outsider and that you don't go to the pub after work.
Well, I don't drink beer. I had kids to raise. It's not a virtue. I was raising kids and I was a political journalist. What do parents do? As soon as they can, they go feed the kids who are now adults, and now I'm a grandmother, so I get to babysit instead. But the reason why I'm described as an outsider is nothing to do with the fact that I don't like beer.
But there is an inside, and it may be one where those worlds have overlapped.
Yeah, but when I started off in covering politics, was at Queen's Park, and I was working for Radio Canada. Bill Davis was in power. The Conservatives in Ontario did not have a lot of gains to make by giving or talking to Radio Canada.
Yeah.
Francophone is in Ontario tend to vote Liberal or NDP, and the Conservative Party was considered by the least friendly to the Francophone minority in those years, fairly or not. So I could see that, you know, there was some kind of back and fro between the power circles and some other journalists in the press gallery, and I certainly wasn't in the loop because why would you have me in the loop? But I also noticed that I didn't seem to know less. Mm-hmm. Then people were getting all this, so I came to this early, possibly misguided conclusion that anything like that was spin and that I wanted to live in a spin-free zone.
Yeah.
And that was that. So I never tried to have contacts. I never called someone to say, spin me, so I know what you're saying. I have the advantage of working in an office at the Star where others have to do stuff like that, so I have a vague sense of what people are actually saying. After a few years, you kind of know from what you hear what the spin probably was.
The closer you get, the further you might find yourself.
By the same token, I would say to anyone who wants to cover politics that if you don't like politicians, you shouldn't. Because if you can't understand them, you're not going to be able to cover them and understand what it is that makes them do what they do. It works best when people cut to the chase or are forced to cut to the chase. Allowing people to give their lines, it's not journalism, and it doesn't serve information to do it that way. Not just you, but many people dislike the strategist sitting together, the three. It's kind of a nightmare. It makes a caricature of politics. By the same token, elected politicians who agree to go on shows to mount the party line as if they leave their brains at the door, they demean their own jobs. At some point, if someone could show that, it would probably improve politics and its coverage. You know, we spent a long time on that issue, tearing up our shirts with a lot of virtue over how the political discourse had become debased and what was happening in question period was, you know, something you really didn't want to watch because it made you feel bad about politics and actually made you feel bad about what you did for a living having to cover that. And then one day someone, and it wasn't me and I don't know who it was, had this notion that maybe instead we should show some of it. You know what? It's had a lot more impact than all those words we wasted. Mm-hmm. Because the politicians who demean themselves by acting like trained seals do not want to be looking at themselves. It's not news, right? They think they get away with it because we're not going to show it because in the end, there's nothing to show. But when you show that side of politics to viewers, they don't like that. They don't like their family to see that. They don't like their kids to say, that's why you're not there all week to do this.
Yeah.
And so I figure if you ever do a show on politics, you should show that stuff.
Yeah.
You should put a price on acting like that, giving a news conference to say nothing, refusing to answer questions, much better than asking every day for an answer, showing someone who repeatedly, and editing it so that it drives the point, this is what you see, much better than all those words we're using.
Here's what they said on Monday. Here they are saying it again on Tuesday.
Yeah.
Here's the next guy saying it on Wednesday.
Yeah.
They did it again.
We don't have enough time, and we don't do enough of showing that.
Yeah.
And it works because a normal human person does not like to see himself or herself doing that stuff. So if I had a politics show, I would create a section of it just to show stuff like that. Because so it's not a picture, but it's worth 1,000 words of punditry that is wasted. Most people can tell when they see something that isn't right.
That's your Canada Land. You can email me at jesse@canadaland.com. I read them all. We're on Twitter at Canada Land. Our website is canadaland.com. Our senior producer is Bruce Thorson. It's been re-edited by Cassidy Villabrun-Barakis with additional production from Tristan Capicchione. Our managing editor is Annette Ejiofor. Our editor-in-chief is Karen Pugliese. I'm your host, Jesse Brown. Our theme music is by So Called. Syndication is handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. You can visit them online at cfuv.ca.
La Banque EQ est au Québec pour vous aider à faire valoir vos avoirs. Comment? Avec un seul compte, vous profiterez de taux d'intérêt élevés et de services bancaires courants sans frais. Il n'y a pas de solde minimal, pas de frais cachés et pas de frais mensuels. Vous aurez toujours nos meilleurs taux, sans exception. Et ouvrir un compte ne prend que quelques minutes. Rendez-vous sur banqueeq.ca.
Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it. Karen Pugliese.
Hey, Jesse Brown.
My boss.
Kind of my boss.
Yeah, when we're over there and I'm publisher, I'm your boss. But in this room, and I'm host, you're my boss.
I can't wait to boss you around.
It's a magical room. Today on the show, politics, polls, pronouns, Peterson, and the press. And the disgraced megachurch pastor who's taking the Toronto Star to court and who's winning. Welcome back to Shortcuts, where we talk shit about the news.
Changes announced by the education minister require, among other things, parental consent for children under 16 who want to identify by a different name and pronoun.
We do not exclude parents in their child's life.
Trans kids in New Brunswick are being told they don't have the right to be their true selves, that they need to ask permission. Well, trans kids need to feel safe, not targeted by politicians.
So my message to Justin Trudeau is butt out and let provinces run schools and let parents raise kids.
Saskatchewan announced a shift today on sex education and the use of pronouns in schools. The move requires students under 16 to get their parents' permission.
Dozens in Saskatoon voicing concern and showing support for the province's LGBTQ2 community.
Karen, as Shortcuts listeners heard on a previous episode, New Brunswick changed their policies for safety for LGBTQ students. The change means that it's no longer mandatory for teachers to use the preferred pronouns or names of transgender or non-binary students under the age of 16, and the teachers need to obtain parental consent for any child who wants to change their name at school. And that was followed with similar legislation last Tuesday in Saskatchewan, where Education Minister Dustin Duncan announced new policies around sex ed
and the use of pronouns in school throughout the province. Then, in Ontario, our education minister said he believes parents must be fully involved if their child chooses to use a different pronoun at school. Conservative leader Pierre Poilievre has picked up the issue. It is sweeping the nation. This is a big issue we all have to deal with.